Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for our next Marquee Moments talk, the series of free talks taking place right here throughout the festival. Please do pick up a leaflet if you haven't done so yet to see the full extent of all the wonderful things happening here throughout the festival. We are delighted to be joined next by Danny Dorling, author of Rule Britannia, who'll be discussing his book and the current state of affairs with Brexit. Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor in Geography at the University of Oxford. In 2015, he was a commissioner of the London Fairness Commission, which reported in 2016. His work concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education, wealth and poverty, and his books include a whole host of bestsellers, including The Real World Atlas, Inequality in the 1%, Population 10, and All That Is Solid. With Friday the 29th of March having been and gone, I am sure there is a lot we can learn from Danny this afternoon. So without any further ado, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Danny Dorling. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. If you don't think your legs will hold out at the back, you can just come and sit down here at the front. Don't worry about that. There is a handout which gives you some idea of mine and Sally's thinking. There aren't enough to go round, so please share them. And in particular, if you could share them with somebody who thinks may have voted differently to you, we could get there if we start talking to each other. The blurb for this talk had four parts, so I'm going to try and stick to what I said I'll do in just half an hour, and then we'll do questions. So the first part about this book, Rule Britannia, co-authored with Sally Tomlinson, is that we argued that the vote to leave the EU was the last gasp of the empire working its way out of the British psyche. And why did we argue that? We spent quite a long time on this book. We began the book around about the time of the vote. We were actually asked to write it by a publisher, who, when he saw what we were writing, dropped us. And it could be terrible. You know, I'm open to that. We will find out in the course of history whether we got it utterly wrong. We sent the manuscript to 20 other publishers, who 19 of them turned us down. Not necessarily because the book was so awful, but because they all had 2, 3, 4, or 5 books on Brexit. By the time we finally got a publishing contract, there were 300 books published on this topic. But luckily for us, this meant we were late. So we carried on writing and rewriting. The book was finally published on the 15th of January, which was the date of Meaningful Vote 1, the biggest defeat of government has ever experienced in the British Parliament. The nostalgia. This thing was a long time coming. We can go back and back for the origins, but I'll just take you back to Margaret Thatcher's resignation. Margaret Thatcher was able to control the Brexiteers in her party, but her replacement, John Major, was not. He talked about the scars on his back that they gave him. And think about that. It mattered so much to them that they were willing to stab their Prime Minister in the back repeatedly to try to get what they want. It dates back to Jimmy Goldsmith forming a new party, sending every household in Britain a VHS cassette at the time of the 1997 general election. This is over 20 years ago. A referendum party for a referendum. Right, it's a long time coming. It goes back to the rise of UKIP. Way back at the end of the 70s and in the 80s, the proportion of people who voted for a far-right party at European election in this country was a zero. When finally, in the late 1980s, National Front, note the National Front, put up an anti-European candidate, they got 0.1% of the vote in the European elections in this country. And then it rose. It rose with UKIP. It rose as various Ulster Unionist parties declared themselves for leaving the European Union. The proportion rose most dramatically in 2014, when 52.9% of people who voted in the European elections in this country voted for a party to the right of mainstream European Conservatives. By 2014, our Conservative Party had left the EPP main bloc in the European Parliament and had allied itself with various other parties in Europe, including, at that time, Alternative for Deutschland. Trying to understand what is going on requires looking back at what you have just lived through and realising that for the last 20 years something has been changing, including our biggest, most powerful political party, which has not just been splitting up but has been moving rapidly towards the right. Behind this is a nostalgia. It's a nostalgia that yesterday was great. Yesterday we had control. We had control of a quarter of the people of the earth. We really did have control. We really were very, very rich. Things were different, and relatively we have slipped down and down and down. And for those who think that it is our rightful destiny to be at the top, and there are many ways in which they may think this. If you look at the textbooks that they were given when they were children, if you look at what their teachers taught, if you look at what happens to an 18-year-old when they arrive in this city, as the majority of them did, to a place in one of the colleges around here, and that they are told they are ever so special, why else would you have a tutor just for yourself? Anyway, I don't blame them. They were set up for this. Why do we have the education system we have in Britain, which is unlike anywhere else on the continent of Europe? Why do we have schools for boys in which you're bored, in which you are taught to behave in a particular way, to be particularly confident, to look down on others below you but know how to deal with them and give them orders? You have that kind of a school system because we had an empire to run. And when the empire went, we didn't dismantle the mechanisms for running an empire at home. We didn't dismantle our incredibly segregated education system. Only one country in the OECD is more segregated, and that is Chile. We didn't touch it. We did bring in comprehensive schools, but then, hey, we managed to segregate by house prices again. And we didn't reform our university system. Most European countries, and Scotland, and the USA, have a university system where you go locally. We have a hierarchical university system because, again, it is extremely efficient for sorting out the small number of people you have on these islands to train some up to go off and run enormous diamond mines down in Africa. It was rational. My department was started by a letter to the Times newspaper explaining that geography needed to be taught in Oxford because we needed young men who were equipped with the skills that would be required for running the colonies. And we look back on this, as much as we do, with an idea that we brought people railways and civilization and order, and we ended slavery. I can go on. But I won't, because you're much more interested in the future, I think, than the past. But if we don't address this past, we will not understand why, out of all 28 European states, it was us that tried to leave first. We are extremely odd. We send by far the largest number of far-right MEPs to the European Parliament. If you're worried about populism in Europe, here is where you need to be worried about. If you wonder why they are not that impressed by us, just think who we've been sending over there. Right? They're annoyed by their one or two far-right MEPs. They're particularly annoyed at our large group of far-right MEPs, far and extreme. Conservatives are far, UKIP are extreme. Secure the funding for those groups, a tiny number in Finland and Sweden and Austria and Hungary, to actually be taken seriously on the mainland. But we don't look at ourselves like that. We don't see our country like that. We don't see our history for what it is and was. My final example I give you before I move on is George Osborne in 2015. George Osborne in 2015 declared that if we were to follow his great economic plan, then within 15 years, by 2030, the UK would be the richest large country on the planet with the highest GDP per head. Why did George Osborne think that was such an important goal, to retake the number one slot? And you have to recognise that this is odd and unusual. In the book, we go through the life histories of the prominent Brexiteers, of Dominic Cummings, of Matthew Elliott, of the people who gave the money, of the people we can try to guess who gave the money and tried to keep themselves secret. And we find an extremely large number of them grew up in a British colony with black servants. It's not a edifying history. Brexit, the first campaign to leave, was not imagined to win. If you wonder why the Leave campaign is now having to face the force of the law, having actually decided to accept the fact it broke the law, they never expected to win first time round, which is why they didn't cover their tracks up. There's so much we now know that we wouldn't have known if it had been 52-48 the other way. So much wouldn't have been investigated. And if it had been 52-48 the other way, we would now be facing a second referendum. Because the rhetoric would have all been everything that carries on going wrong would have been the fault of immigrants and the betrayal of the elite who fixed the result. And the great people of Britain, led by their new Prime Minister, which would have been Boris Johnson. He was the most disappointed man on the day of the result. The great British people will rise again. What's happened, and I think it's brilliant that it's happened, is that everything has been rapidly brought forward. The bluff has been called, and we are where we find ourselves today. Three more bits, so I got to be fast. The result was driven by a lack of knowledge of Britain's imperial history, by a profound anxiety about the status today, and by a deeply unrealistic vision of our future. Things had gone badly, badly wrong. Without the 2008 global financial crash, we probably wouldn't be here. But before that, we had managed to arrange things such that we went from the position where we entered the European Economic Community in the early 1970s, being the second most equitable large country in Europe. Only Sweden was more equitable than we were in the 70s. For those of you old enough to remember the dream of how things could have been different in the 60s and 70s, it was true. I sometimes blame my parents for not having fought hard enough, but they were fighting against the imperial legacy. We are now, and have been for some years, by far the most unequal country in the European community. Our Gini coefficient of income is the highest. The top 10% of people in this country take 40% of all income every day, every year, leaving 60% for 90% of the population. If you want to cause disharmony, that is how you do it. If you want to engineer a housing crisis, handing over 4/10 of income to just 10% of people is why the other 90% cannot get the mortgage or just get the mortgage. Why they're forced to rent from a private landlord in a way that you do not have to rent anywhere else in the continent. I can go on, but we were in a terrible situation, and that helps the vote happen. In 2014, for men and women, the life expectancy in this country stopped rising. It then fell. These figures come from ONS. ONS released them by accident. It is now becoming more and more obvious. The great news is if you've got a pension, how many people have got a pension? Just get an idea. Oldies, put up your hand. Young people, turn around and look angry. The great news is that our pension schemes are rapidly becoming solvent. The bad news is we do not realise that is not good news. Life expectancy falling. David Cameron's happiness index that he brought in 2010 regularly reported year by year, although the press never reported it, that a growing proportion of people said their health was getting worse. We didn't believe them. We thought they were moaning. And then they started dying. in more and more numbers. 2015, infant mortality begins to rise. Rise in 2016, 2017, 2018. The only place in Europe where babies are becoming less and less likely to survive the first 2 or 3 days of life. It is still bloody good. I mean, I can overemphasize, you know, we still have a good health service. The chance arises, I'm talking about, an extra 1 baby in 1,000 dying. But if it's your baby, it doesn't really matter that it was 1 in 1,000. In this county, in the last few months, of the 6 midwifery services, 5 have had to close with almost no warning and move the midwives to the JR. And you are told, when you check on Facebook, to get yourself to the JR if you've gone into labour. So don't go into labour at 6 o'clock in the morning from the Cotswolds. Things went badly wrong, but the large majority of people who voted to leave lived in the south of England. The majority were social class A, B or C1. The large majority were traditionally Conservative or UKIP voters. This result was made in Surrey and Wiltshire and Dorset and Sussex and Cornwall. But because of our blinkered few and complete innumeracy, we have spent over 1,000 days pointing the finger at Stoke and Mansfield and Middlesbrough and Blaenau Ffestiniog. Honestly, I mean, I'm to blame. I'm a professor of bloody geography at the University of Oxford. I have been trying to get this over. It simply requires adding up and taking away. There is no long division required in working out who voted for it in the greatest numbers and with the highest turnout. So it is not that there are more people living in the south. For exactly the same electorate, more people voted leave. And the people who voted leave in greatest numbers were the constituents of the MPs who are now desperate to try to still get this country out. And their party, and really interestingly, their party has changed, the Conservative Party, in a way which has shocked the City of London. The City of London thought it was their party. They thought they owned it, after all they were paying for it. But the membership of the Tory party became smaller and smaller and further to the right and older, to such a point where I went to a seminar on Thursday night organised by the Dai Wai Foundation, which is funded by the Dai Wai Bank, which is one of many medium-sized banks in London, where the banker, and bankers rarely speak in public, explained, yes, they've moved the offices out of London. At first, it will only be the chief executive and the chief operating officer and the rest of the senior members of the board and the core management supporting team and the capital that is out of the UK. The back office, note the back office, what was the headquarters in London, the back office will probably remain for up to 12 years. Because there's no need to shut it down that quickly. And he was livid. He couldn't believe the stupidity of this. He said it's been really expensive. It's cost us a fortune to establish a new headquarters. And not just them. So many of the other banks have now moved. And he said it doesn't matter what happens now. The trust has gone. The trust has gone. The idea of this country being a competent home for somebody to, I mean, I would call it slightly rip off other people and make an enormous profit. I am not particularly sad that the banking industry of Europe is being spread out across the continent. I happen to think that might be one of the good things coming out of Brexit. But in the short term, we have to make enough money to pay for the food. And the sad news is that the banking did tip the balance to make enough money to pay for the food. There has been almost no discussion about services. All the discussion has been about manufacturing. The majority of our productivity comes from services. There were only 115 words. 115 words is about 4 lines. In the 588-page document that has now been roundly rejected 3 times, understandably, by members of Parliament. If you're trying to work out what we can do to make a living, I'll give you one example from this city. In this city, we have many things that are productive, but 2 things in particular. We have a couple of universities and we have a car plant. That car plant rolls a mini off every minute and 2 seconds. I estimate that the profit made on that mini is similar to the excess, can't call it profit because we don't make a profit, but just to say, the money that is raised from having an overseas postgraduate student, which to be honest is what allows the undergraduate students and everything else in this place to operate. We produce a postgraduate student from the two universities every hour. The mini plant produces a mini a minute. It is 60 times more productive than we are. You take that mini plant out of Oxford, you cannot expand the two universities to be 30 times larger than they are. This is the kind of problem we have. You can bring in 4 or 5, maybe 10 times as many tourists. You might not like the idea. You certainly got to get the buses out to the middle of Oxford as well as the cars. And you've got to spread them out, and every college has to have a Harry Potter wizard. I have tried to think this thing through, but we are in trouble. Tourism at least is on the rise. Reconciling ourselves. What are we going to do? Reconciling ourselves to a new beginning and a chance to carve out a new identity. 10 days to go. 10 days. And the options are somehow cobbling together something which the EU27 will accept as a reason for a long delay. Now, they may. I will be surprised if they do manage to do that. But somehow cobbling something together, presenting it by about the 8th or the 7th of April, it being accepted by all 27, and the agreement being signed by Friday week. Anyway, you never know. That's option one. Option two, which runs out at 11 o'clock on the 12th of April, is to send a letter to Brussels, calling it a red, white and blue delay after serious consideration. I'll tell you quietly what the other word for it is. Don't tell anybody else. The other word is revoke. Last minute, after you tried everything else, as a number of MPs who actually begin to not vote against it rises, happens. That is possible. There may be Zimmer frames on the streets, but we do have the territorial army. In the indicative votes, more MPs did not oppose revoke than did not oppose the second referendum. I know it's a double negative, but remember they were allowed to abstain. You quietly ask the MPs what they would like to see. They don't want to be seen as the first ones to say it, apart from whatever it was, 160 have already come out. Revoke doesn't solve your problems. This is going to go on for decades and decades. All revoke does means that the medicine arrives, means that the lorry park doesn't get bigger and bigger, means you don't have to consider this, the fact that the White Cliffs of Dover actually make it hard to park the trucks, and can you level them a bit? That's part of the ridiculous planning I've seen. You don't have to worry about the decaying carcasses of sheep on the M20. You don't have to worry about the sudden exodus of people who have no rights from this country, who actually make the country work. You don't have to worry about the influx from the mainland. Not of everybody, just of the people who currently live in the mainland of Europe who are British citizens who fall ill and need to be treated and need a house when they come back. And the last thing to say about crashing out is still quite possible. You'll have noticed their ability to work things out isn't great, although 500 of them are obviously against it. The worst thing about crashing out, which Project Fear has never raised, I think partly to its credit, because I don't think it's worth worrying people. Our bank's solvency depends on the capitalisation of the British housing market. If house prices fall, Mark Carney has said 30%, but they don't have to fall by 30%. If house prices fall, we fail the Basel tests of solvency for the banks. When you fail to test the solvency, there are things the banks are no longer allowed to do. If you want to see what happens, we've got a brilliant example. It is Greece after 2008 and 2009. And yes, you've got the army, and you've hired 300,000 emergency civil servants, but none of them can make a cash point work if the cash point has been instructed, because of capital controls, not to let you have more than €800 a month. That, to be honest, that's my biggest fear. If you want to know why I don't want us to crash out, it is the cash points. There's enough food to eat, and we're good at queuing. And even better than that, if we're clever, we could get Weight Watchers to do it, and your ration would depend on what the weighing scale said, and we could go within a year from being the fattest nation in Europe to being the thinnest. But remember, already frail, elderly people, babies who are born in worse circumstances are dying at higher rates already. Crashing out would accelerate that. This is the kind of thing that happens to former empires when they fall. This is what happened to the USSR after 1989. Right? There is a precedent for this. Not accepting where you're at and doggedly going on and on is actually the normal behaviour of a former empire, which has created a mindset that says, against all the odds, you keep on trying. It is your patriotic duty to do so. What's going to happen? Regardless of which of those events happen. What almost certainly will happen is that things will get better. That is not a difficult prediction to make, because when you rank so low on so many league tables, odds on, things actually get better. The bluff has been called. The idea that this country, which went out yet again and opened up to the AA countries early and invited people in and then complained about them. We have form on this. Enoch Powell did this in the Caribbean when I was a child. He went out and asked people to come, almost so he could then do that speech later. He was the Minister for Health. We're not going to be able to blame immigration anymore for our stupidity. We're not going to be able to blame immigration for the fact that it costs so much to have a home. That is entirely of our making. We cannot blame the European Union for being a terrible place that makes everything worse, because it is home to the most equitable, happy countries on the planet right now. Somehow they managed to do it. We are not going to have faith any longer in politicians who tell us to trust them because they know what is best for us. That goes. We're not going to have a young population who don't vote anymore. They started voting again for the first time since the 1980s. The poll tax kicked the votes out of them. And we got the biggest, fastest swing ever in the 2017 general election. We're not going to have disengagement from politics. We have the largest political party now in the whole of Europe. And just to help them along, I don't know how many people might have signed a petition for revoke, but the Prime Minister very kindly sent you all an email telling you how much she was going to ignore you. It's as if she wants to kind of give you a reason to get active and get involved. Let's say a last thing about Corbyn, because it'll come up. Now, he has many, many faults. Huge numbers. I bet I can list more than you can. But the one thing he knows about, and his advisors know about, is how you behave in opposition when you do not have a majority. He has a lifetime's experience of that. He has a lifetime experience of being pilloried and taken apart, and knowing that whatever happened a few months ago, can you remember the terrible events of November, October? Have you got any memory of that? Or is all your mind focused on the last week? He knows what you do to defeat an opposition when you are not in a position of power. His party have defeated for the first time in over 40 years the government's finance bill. They are holding together to defeat the government on their attempt, or that part of the government, to do this. He suffers from being ridiculously honest. When he said he is 70% in favour of Remain, that is what he meant. His MPs, of course, are much more in favour of Remain and staying in than he has. But the one thing I'd ask you to think about him is how it will look in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months when you watch the events of the next 10 days play out. What will the story be about the part that Labour have played, and in particular the Labour leadership have played? Because I don't think it's going to be quite so damning as the press put it. And the last thing I'll say about Corbyn, if you remember, he was trying to get a seat on the train. Do you remember that? He told the journalists why, and they didn't report it. I mean, you can see him saying it. He said, I need two seats. He needed two seats because his wife wanted to talk to him. His wife wanted to talk to him because she'd married him to retire, and he was approaching 70 years of age, and she wanted him to stop doing this. And because the silly man wouldn't just sit in two seats when one was reserved, oh no, he should have just done that. He ends up crouching down in a luggage rack looking all sulky. But he told people what was going on. He has absorbed all the anger, vitriol, libel. I've never met anybody who's less anti-Semitic than Jeremy Corbyn. He's absorbed it all, and when he retires, whoever becomes the leader, preferably a woman under the age of 45, in my book there are lots of them, whoever becomes leader is for at least 6 months going to look absolutely brilliant. I would like it to just be 6 months before an election, because they can take you apart after 6 months. The honeymoon is over. They'll weed in and find something to go for. Jeremy Corbyn has acted as a buffer for whoever takes over, so that hopefully they'll only have to go through 6 months of it before they are the Prime Minister, very possibly in coalition with the Scottish National Party. Thank you very much for your attention. Please think of a question. And you'll have to shout. Yeah.
Danny, super talk as always. To risk of sounding personal, I take on board what you say about the explicitly of Oxford. I was current Prime Minister as a student of geography, as you know, in this university.
Yeah.
How come she never learned anything?
How come did Theresa May not learn a great deal as she came to study geography? Between us, it's not... We have it more difficult than that. Jeremy Corbyn's first job? Geography teacher. But geography back in the 1970s, 1980s, was a very different subject. It was the tail end of empire. That's where they were taught capital cities, how rivers work, because you might be in charge of a very large river, and so on. Geography's changed. It's changed because of climate change, and we now study inequality. We don't train young people to rule colonies anymore. But she arrived at Oxford at a time when there wasn't much being taught that would have been of much use to her. I'll put it that bluntly. The department has changed a great deal since then, but departments all across the country. But also when she arrived, she immediately immersed herself in the Conservative Party and was largely involved in that. When she was only 18, these people are formed. We're all formed by the experiences we had. At the same age I grew up here, I went to the nearest school to Theresa's school. She was also separated. Her dad had tried really hard, so she never had to go to school with everybody else. She went to a religious school at one point, a private school at one point. He managed to get her into the last year at Wheatley Park, which was grammar. So she had an upbringing which was separated. In the fields of wheat, you know, 4 miles that way. I, the same age, went from here up to Newcastle in the 1980s and lived in a city for 10 years in which the majority of households had no work. I mean, that was my education. My departments were lovely. I did maths and geography. But the real education I got was coming up from being a middle-class boy in this town, which way back then had no worries. They'd only just not taken on the first set of lads in the car factory. And walking into the devastation that had been caused by the Conservatives in Newcastle. I mean, you get your education from your life experience and from where you live and from your family as much as you ever get it from a textbook and from how you're taught. You've got to be careful. got, are there any women? Yes.
Yeah, I understand that only 7% of the population actually goes to private public schools. Mm. And they really have that power, and to really still have that mindset of communism, empire,
yeah,
it's very foreign and alien.
Okay, only 7% of the population of the UK go to private or public schools. It's much higher in this city. Can they really have that power? It seems odd. But they do. I mean, not all. I'm not damning all private and public schools. And of course, they've changed their curriculum. Well, and of course, it's no child's fault where their parents choose to send them. I think that's really important. It is a bit of a waste of money nowadays. But anyway, in the past, if you'd sent a child to Magdalen College School in this city, you would increase their chances of going to university by about 15 to 20 times. Right? Now, go to Cheyne, you'll be going to Manchester and Leeds University if you study hard and you're a bit geeky. Go to Magdalen, you'll be going to Manchester or Leeds University. So things are differed. But when you look at who has all the top jobs, it is incredibly concentrated. Most with the judiciary, in just a few elite schools, at least with university vice chancellors, who are the most meritocratic group, ironically. But still not that meritocratic. Most of my dealings in my working life with people I work with in London, with publishing, I am always, almost always, talking with somebody who went to a private school. That is just what Britain is now. And occasionally, people go to me, "Oh, Danny, well done, you went to a comprehensive," without any realisation that that's what 93% of us did. And it's changing. But it's nobody's fault they went to an exclusive school. And in some ways, it isn't the parents' fault that they were driven partly by fear. Fear of the other, fear of their children mixing, fear of their children's future. Fear, in a country this unequal, where only 10% have 40% of all income, if you could, wouldn't you do all you could to try to make sure your child was in that top 10%? Inequality drives private education. Reduce the inequality, and there are so many ways in which you can do that. Reduce the inequality, and then what is the point of spending more money so that your child has to take a longer trip in the morning, has to wear an itchy uniform, can't be friends anymore with the other children on the street, no matter what you may say about that. But don't worry, they'll meet them again at university, some of them. Has to be pushed to get, you know, 3 or 4 higher GCSEs than they'd ever get, so that they're pushed on and on and up. Beyond what they would otherwise do, increasing the chances of failing later in life. The group of people with the highest death rate in Britain are men who went to a private or grammar school in the 40s or 50s and were doing okay in midlife, but then failed, and they actually have the highest mortality rate. So I'm not completely angry about people who went to elite education, because because it sets you up for feeling that you're such a massive disappointment later on if you do not succeed. It's a terrible thing we do to our children, which we have to stop doing. We have to become a normal country. We are twinned with Bonn. And if you compare this city to Bonn and the schools of this city to the schools of Bonn, and you talk to a teacher in Bonn, they will find it very hard to rank their schools. The Beethoven Academy is a bit botcher. It's kind of like Charwell, but not as, you know, there's no summer town in Bonn. And they have a couple of private schools. I wouldn't ban them. And they're nice about their private schools. Their private schools are for very rich, very slow boys, of which the most famous alumni from their top private school is Prince Philip. You know, that is what a normal European city is like. It's going to take a long time. It'll be 20, 30 years before this city and this country is anything like cities in the Netherlands, cities in Germany, cities in France. But inequality is incredibly expensive to maintain. And of the many silver linings of Brexit, one is that we will not be able to afford to carry on behaving like this anymore. Because those bankers, that wages have been falling since 2016. The European Banking Authority monitors the number getting more than a million. The number of parents who can afford to pay the fees for St Paul's and Westminster and Eton is dropping. You can bring in more children from abroad, and hey, that's export earnings, and we need them. But we can no longer afford to carry on as we were. Things are going to change. The last time we had anything like this, and this is much bigger than that, was the Suez crisis. National embarrassment, the elite out of touch, shouldn't have done it. And within 4 years of the Suez crisis, we begin to get the beginnings of an almighty change. For me, it begins with a judge turning round to a jury and saying, is this a book you would like your wife and servants to read? And that jury, because the elite had lost their status, turning around and saying, we don't have servants, and some of us are wives. And then right through to the 1964 government, through to, for the first time ever in this country, changing the education system so we no longer segregated our children, through to bringing in proper social security, social workers, improving things, through to a point where we could actually worry later that somebody called Kathy was wheeling, you know, her kids around in a pram. We got all of that from a debacle called Suez. So what could we get from this? And it'll be led by the young. They're the most pissed off. In Brussels, over 100,000 young people are congregating on Fridays now because of climate change. 100,000 students and school children in Belgium. It is, you know, we are more lethargic. So we've really, really got to wreck the futures of our young to actually get them out of bed. But we are doing the best we can at that. You know, I wouldn't arrange it this way. But if this doesn't kick Britain up the arse, God knows what will. Lady there?
How do you see, with politics going on, how do you see England's...
Can you shout out louder, sorry?
England's voice internationally.
Yeah.
And England's influence, do you see it?
Yeah. England's influence internationally is declining. That's part of the reason for this, because it was declining before. When I first went abroad, I was 15, and a school trip to France, and we could get 10 francs for a pound. So, you know, the older you are, you've got a cent. You know, you just know you were kings on overseas holidays if you could do that. We're about to plummet. You know this fifth largest nation in the world thing? That's based on the exchange rate 2 years ago. So already I can work out how fast we get down to 12. Simply on what's already happened, not having to make a prediction, just when the World Bank recalculates, because it all lags. We claim to have the second largest arms industry in the world. Actually turns out we're number six. But we have the only government that would actually make the claim of having an arms industry that was bigger than the real thing. It'll be good for us. It'll be good for us to drop down for a bit. We haven't been particularly helpful. Our weapons in the Yemen are causing enormous damage. We do things like send an aircraft carrier to the South China Sea. I mean, this costs money. Apart from the huge amount of money it'll lose us by pissing off the people who live over there. Actually fueling and buying and building an aircraft carrier as some kind of extension of your body to show how virile you are really is just pathetic. And I wouldn't worry about the drop. Where I'd get the optimism from is looking at other places who dropped. I was looking today at the Habsburg Empire, which collapsed in 1918-1919. Vienna's a lovely place now, right? But you have to go down and recognise that what was something you were so proud of wasn't necessarily all as good as you thought, and there isn't something special about you that means you should rule. The really hard thing we've got to learn is that we're going to have to do stuff that pays our way, and we tell ourselves a myth of our inventiveness. I was taught at school how we invented everything. The spinning jenny, every other kind of loom part or whatever, and that's why we were rich. I was never taught at school that we shipped people across the Atlantic, made them pick cotton, shipped it back, made people in India buy the cotton, destroyed their textile industry, caused famines for hundreds of thousands of them, and then shipped under Palmerston our opium under the name Free Trade to China and destroyed its civilization. The number of things I could have learnt at school would be enormous. So we're going to have to go through this period of actually reassessing who we are and then work out what it is we're going to do, because we did so well out of trade because people didn't have a choice about buying our stuff. When they had a choice, they stopped buying our ships. It's like that, because you could get a better ship made in Korea cheaper, or made in Germany. That's working out what we're going to do. I mean, this is a great example. You know, that little bridge of size, right? That's pretty. Okay, it might be a copy of somebody else's bridge of size somewhere else, but let's forget about that. The question is, how can you funnel 10 times as many tourists past that than we currently do? You might not like it if you live here like me, but we're going to have to do that. Opposite it, the Western Library, the university's first ever public building. Okay, bulletproof glass so you can't get towards the books. And a public toilet. There is a toilet. The University of Oxford is providing a toilet for anybody to use. I mean, this is, I'm an optimist. This is great progress. It's partly there to help drag tourism down to this end of Broad Street, because Cornmarket is full. And this is a microcosm, but we're in Oxford. One of the things we're going to have to do is to spread the tourists out within this city. We have to find a way of housing some of them overnight, because you make more money, and because you've travelled to other places, this city is actually interesting enough to spend 2 days in, not simply arrive by coach and go again. These are the things we're going to have to do in the short term, before we begin to do the things that other countries do. And we have 200 years of missing history, if you like, when we haven't had to pay our way while telling ourselves at the same time how brilliantly great we were.
Just bought the book, and yeah. Page 29, you say that it was less a protest vote, the referendum, and more to do with five factors, which are all to do with turnout by region or age.
Yes.
But surely there was a core of protest vote from the destroyed Newcastle-type places that you mentioned earlier.
Okay.
What proportion of it was that, and what can we do about that?
Yes. So this is about, at the start of the book, Sally and I say this is not mainly a protest vote from places like Newcastle. It's about age and turnout. I tweeted today to somebody who was going on at me about Mansfield. Mansfield's 70% leave. About 39,000 people. 10 times as many people voted leave in Surrey.
You get that point.
There is an element of protest. For many people in Britain, in fact for most people in Britain, this is the first time they'd ever been given a vote that would matter. Their local parliamentary vote in Mansfield, nothing was ever going to change in Mansfield. You know, all you were doing was backing the traditional Labour Party. So this is the first time we gave, and the other referendum we had, they weren't going anywhere. And you gave people a choice between carry on as we are, and support David Cameron and everything laid up behind him, or say you've had too much of that. I think most of the vote leave was more positive. It was older people wanting a better future for their grandchildren. We know the vast bulk of the vote was older, and it was older people in parts of the South East, in Wiltshire, in Devon and Cornwall, wanting their grandchildren to be able to get a home and start a family, which they, on the main, can't do at the moment. So it was about rebuilding a better Britain, having another £350 million for the health service. Nobody said, if we wanted a German health service, we need £1 billion a week. They spend £1 billion more, not because they're bigger, but because they tax properly. That's how you don't have to queue on the trolley at the JR. It's as simple as that. So part is a protest, but I'd say the biggest protest is the old of the South East protesting about their grandchildren's future. And mistakenly, because if you look at the newspapers that the old of the South East read, which is the Daily Mail and the Telegraph, those newspapers have been telling them, your grandchildren will be able to get a home as long as we stop the immigrants coming in and living in their home. What the Telegraph has never done it said we actually have more bedrooms per person than we've ever had in this country, but we have managed to redistribute them in the worst possible way. So we have more empty rooms, more empty houses than ever before. And I'll give you just one example. Take a former maisonette in parts of Blackbird Leys here, which would have housed under need, under allocation, a mum and dad and two children when I was growing up. So four people in that maisonette. They buy it under right to buy because it makes complete sense because of the discount to buy, and it's Blackbird Leys. That's what I forget, you don't, in case you don't know, you're talking a fortune. This is going to be worth £300,000. So you buy your maisonette under right to buy. When you come to sell it, you think you're going to be selling it to a family like you. But a man comes along with an extra £10,000. He doesn't tell you why he wants it, but he buys it. And he's a landlord. And he then rents out the maisonette. And he rents it out to whoever is going to pay the most rent and will be most reliable. So the last people he wants to put in is a family with children. He might even feel a bit guilty if he has to evict them. What he puts in is a young professional working in a university. One person instead of four people in the house. It's unbelievably inefficient, and the worst thing about it is that one person then goes and moans about the fact they have to live in Blackbird Leys. You couldn't make it up over how to cock up our housing, our health service, our education service. But I would blame the legacy. I would say we're not genetically stupid. This is the hangover that happens to places. We're taught of a certain thing, and it takes generations to change that thinking around. And if you want to know how to do a housing system, look at Vienna. Vienna has the best system of housing in the whole of Europe, and it took them longer to establish it. But you can look at the Netherlands, you can go all over the continent. You know, we've got a whole continent that does better than us in some cases in almost everything. And we turn and we look at the United States, which is the only place that does worse. Are you going to tell me I'm... Can I do one more question?
One more and then we have to call it quits.
Okay, one more. We do you at the back. Shout out.
Yeah. You've described a situation and made allusions to not enough taxation. It's not a unique situation. A lot of politicians are running on lower tax rates. You know, it seems to be myopic, and people buy it. What could your studies, your observations, tell us, indicate about a turnaround?
Okay. How do we get a turnaround about tax rates? Things like
that seems to be the core of, you know, the education system, the health system. I mean, it was the LSE economist said 0.8% of education budget, because we would have avoided Brexit, or you would have avoided Brexit.
We'd have avoided, but yeah. It's how to do it. I mean, it's getting over things. Taxation is a privilege, so starting off by saying you're very lucky to live in a country with a relatively high rate of taxation. It correlates with incredible services, and you don't see people dying, well, I say dying in the street, but we've had six people die in these streets. So the start of simply explaining. They're secondly explaining that when people don't pay their taxes, they are stealing from you. Explaining that actually it is a form of theft, and the theft is actually fairly devastating because it funds incubators for babies, but the visit from a social worker. Then explaining the efficiency of taxation. So there are many things which are more efficiently provided collectively than individually we would do. We are brilliant individually at things like buying our clothes. There's a whole set of things where you'd never want the state involved. But the problem is that we extrapolate the things that we are good at to everything. You know, we think, oh, if I just had enough money, I would choose the best education for my children. Not realizing how much you would actually muck them up by what you did with the money. So, and it's teaching that some things are done better collectively and some things are done better privately, and the line is not easy in between. But one of the things, just to give you a final example that we need to teach, the rest of Europe has higher rates of marginal tax, say 60-70% on incomes of over €200,000. And this, I think this is very simple, but this is one point that's never got over. The reason they have higher marginal rates of tax, income tax, and there are many other taxes which are efficient, by the way, not just income, is not to raise more money. The Conservatives always oppose higher rates of tax because they say it won't raise more money. And the Conservatives aren't being devious, they just don't get it. The reason for a higher rate of tax is to stop people asking at the top for higher incomes, because the majority of that money will then go simply to the Exchequer. I'll give you one example. In this university, if you're in the senior management team, and I don't know, you're being paid 400,000, and you decide that you'd like to be paid 450,000. If you knew that 90%, say, of that extra £50,000, it's only 50,000 and you're running a really big important university, but if you knew that 90% of that extra £50,000 was going to go in tax and you'd only get 10 grand, would you ask for it? And would the remuneration committee give it you? Or alternatively, would you take that £50,000 that the University of Oxford has and fund 2 scholarships for children, young adults, to study for a postdoctoral qualification instead? High marginal tax rates deters people from being greedy and encourages a more efficient spread of spending, which is why the countries of Europe that do the best, which have the lowest rates of homelessness, the cheapest housing, the best quality housing, the best results from education, and so on, have high marginal rates of taxation. Because we're all a bit greedy and we need help to stop us asking for more and more just for ourselves. Thank you ever so much for your attention.
I'd just like to say, as always, we could have just carried on listening for like another hour. I feel like there's so much that we've learned today, so much that's been said. It's been so insightful. Copies of Danny's and Sally's book, Rule Britannia, is on this table here. There are more, so don't worry if you find the tiles low, I can get more. Thank you all for coming, and we hope to see you again at another event right here. And thank you to Danny. It's amazing.